Well, welcome to Retail Intel, the podcast where we dive deep into the dynamic world of commercial real estate. I'm your host, Brian Sheehan, and I'm thrilled to be your guide on this journey through the bustling streets of retail, the aisles of shopping centers, and the world of commercial property investment. With me today is Eric Taylor, founder and CEO of Salon Republic. Eric is also host of the Hair Game podcast and chair of the Professional Beauty Federation of California. If you're not familiar with Salon Republic, it is a complete rethinking of the ideal working environment for today's beauty professionals. Not just a salon, but a one-of-a-kind experience curated by each beauty pro. I'm excited to learn more. Eric, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So how have you been? How's business?
Well, I've been great. I'm in California right now. We're having one of those quote-unquote atmospheric rivers, so things are flooding. And some people are enjoying it, some people aren't. My office, actually, since this is a real estate podcast, those listeners might enjoy or not enjoy hearing about the flooding of my office. So as we speak, my feet are in are on some wet carpet.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it looks sunny, but you're near a window, I think, and
yep.
I wouldn't have guessed you're flooded out there.
Yeah, but that's okay. Life moves on.
Well, I'd love to start with your background. So you founded Salon Republic close to, what, 25 years ago?
Yeah.
What were prior to founding?
Sure. I went to college. I went to Pepperdine. I studied finance in college. I went to Pepperdine to play baseball, and my baseball career got truncated by an injury. So then I had to get real about life, and I figured finance was a good thing to learn. And so that's what I did, and right before graduating, I was kind of struggling to think of a good way to spend my time after I graduated. This was in the late 90s, and for those listeners who are old enough, they remember that this was the dot-com craze. And so I had a lot of friends going into investment banking. I had a lot of friends who were doing the dot-com thing. Some guys were going into incubators, if the listeners remember those things, right? You hire a bunch of supposedly really smart people, you pay them a lot of money, you throw them in a really fancy office, and then they're just supposed to magically come up with some really good business ideas.
Great business idea, yep.
Right? And Global Crossing, you know, those days. So a lot of my friends were doing that, and I thought, boy, this is interesting, but I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. My dad was in the real estate business. His dad was in the construction and real estate business in New York City, and I thought, okay, so I've learned quite a bit about that because his office was in our house as I was growing up. I kind of saw him renting out his industrial real estate, mostly his warehouse space. And growing up, my brother and I were sent around to the tenants during the holidays, and we would give away turkeys to the tenants. You know, that's kind of old school. Landlords don't do that kind of stuff anymore. But so I was raised in that kind of traditional real estate environment. And then on the other side of the coin was my mother, who was a professional oil painter. She had her studio in the house, and she was actually rather successful as an oil painter. And, you know, what was interesting about growing up and watching her become a successful artist was, you know, she had to temper her creativity with the reality of having to sell something to somebody who was willing to pay for it. So, you know, she couldn't go off into these wild creative tangents. If she wanted to sell something, she needed to balance that creativity with what people actually wanted to buy. And so I watched her do this, and she ended up having quite a career and painted many famous people. She did portraiture as well as landscape art, and sold art to very wealthy people, and painted some famous athletes. Emmett Smith, she painted Jim Brown. She painted the Supreme Court Justice Warren Berger before he passed. She painted the King of Mongolia. So she had created this great career where so few artists are able to do it. And so there are so many lessons in growing up in a household where you had these two influences. So I wanted to be an entrepreneur as well. And so as I was approaching graduation at school, I thought to myself, you know, my time is never going to be less valuable than now. You know, whatever path I choose, I'm going to get experience, and I'm going to all of a sudden start having expectations of what I should be getting paid. And so now is the time, upon graduating from college, to try things. And so I was very interested in unconsolidated industries. I looked at car washes. I looked at dry cleaners. I looked at beauty services, hair salons, because these are industries that are everywhere, yet very few companies actually had very much of the market. And to me, that meant opportunity for somebody who knew as little as I knew coming out of college. And I didn't have a lot of money. As much as I'm saying that my parents were successful, middle class, you know, we were able to have a nice house. We belonged to a middle of the road country club. So not rich, but they did well enough to provide a comfortable life for my brother and I. Certainly not enough to really backstop, you know, a bunch of ideas that their kids might have. So long story short, I looked at these various industries, and I was finding the salon industry to be one that combined the artistry of my mother with the kind of pragmatic, necessary sort of business of real estate. And, you know, people have to get their hair cut. Most people, Brian, I don't want to insult you, but I'm looking through the...
It's been a while.
computer screen, and I don't see a lot to cut. But in the hair industry, we like to say it's what we leave on, it's not what we take off. So
I love it.
So I thought, you know, everybody's got to get their hair cut, and you know, women love to get their hair colored, and it just seems like such a resilient business. I think I'm gonna put some effort into this. So when I graduated from Pepperdine in Malibu, California, I moved back to Texas, which is I'm from Dallas, and I had a girlfriend there. And her hairstylist moved to one of the first studio-based salons that had ever been created. Nowadays, some people call this the salon suites industry.
Mm-hmm.
I like to call them like studio-based salons. What I eventually ended up doing, what Salon Republic now is quite a bit different than a lot of the franchises like Sola and Phoenix, and we'll get into that a little bit. But her hairstylist moved to one of the first studio-based salons, and she got home and called me on the landline because she was living with her parents as well at the time, and she said, "You got to check this place out." And it was 5 minutes from my parents' house, and I jumped in the car, drove down the street, walked in, and it made immediate sense to me. You know, that salon was 10,000 square feet. The salon is still there, in fact. I mean, and we're going back 26 years, okay? If anything, there's going to be a recurring theme in this conversation, that is the resilience of this business. That salon is still there. It's about 10,000 square feet. It's got about 60 studios in it. And I initially walked in all those years ago, and it made immediate sense to me. It was the perfect combination of the environment in which I was raised between my mom and my dad. The founder of the concept, his name was Keith, he was there in the salon that day, and he approached me and asked if I needed help. And I said initially, "I'm looking to get a haircut." I lied to him. I said, I'm here to get a haircut. And that led to him walking me around the salon and kind of telling me about the salon. And as we were walking, I saw a bunch of happy beauty professionals that had their own spaces. They had their own studios, and they're working happily with their clients. And I could see that some had their doors closed and they had privacy, and some had their doors open and they could be kind of part of the greater thing of what was happening there in the salon. And people kind of had control over their environment. And so I said to Keith, I said, "You know, to be honest with you, I did not come in here to get my hair cut. I just graduated from college, and my girlfriend's hairdresser works here, and she told me about it, and it sounded amazing. So I wanted to come see it for myself, and I think it's really spectacular what you're doing here, and would you mind if I kind of hang around? You don't have to pay me. I can, you know, I'll give me things to do. You know, I'll take out the trash. I'll, you know, I don't know much about things, but I'd like to learn." And so I worked for him for free for about a year, and he was my mentor. And I learned what beauty professionals, how they work. I learned what they like. I learned what they need to be successful. I learned that the clients love the privacy that they get with their beauty professional and the ups and downs of the business. So, and then after about a year, I dumped the girlfriend and I moved back out to California, where there were no such salons. And in 2000, I opened the first Salon Republic, which was in Studio City, California.
That's incredible. I'll be honest, the first time I walked into a studio-based salon, it was a little lost on me. I was confused. You know, I went with my mom. This was probably, like you said, 20, 25 years ago. And I didn't understand if it was all one business or different businesses. And so I guess for somebody that's unfamiliar with it, how do you explain a studio-based salon to someone?
Well, I essentially say that we take a large space between about 8,000 and 25,000 square feet. And, well, frankly, it depends who I'm talking to. If I'm talking to a real estate guy, I would say I subdivide the space into individual studios that we then rent to independent beauty professionals. And then, you know, we maintain the facility, we layer in certain amenities, and that's the essence of that version of the description. If I'm talking to, let's say, one of my wife's, you know, girlfriends, I'm like, you know, we have a salon where everybody has their own space, where everybody has their own studio, and they work independently in there. And, I mean, you know, typically that's good enough to do the job. But I've found that after all these years, unless somebody actually walks in, they don't quite get it.
Yeah, you really do have to go in to understand it. And you explaining your background makes perfect sense then, how you kind of got here, which is that combination of art and science and real estate. And so I get that a little bit, but what is it that kind of drives you in this industry, this business? You clearly have a passion and a talent for it. You got gray hair. You know, so I mean, it kind of makes sense, but like, what do you love about studio-based salons?
So, you know, what's interesting about that question is I'm not sure I even recognized the answer until a number of years after I started the business. But the answer is just so obvious, and it really is the fact that I grew up in an entrepreneurial environment with each of my parents doing their own thing, eating what they kill, right? And that was a lot of my explanation of my mom's situation. You know, she needed to make money, and she had to balance things out, the art and the pragmatism of making something commercially viable. And that, to me, I just loved it. It seemed, frankly, starting a business, running a business, I mean, it is so much part of my DNA. I almost feel like every individual needs to do it. There's so much that can be learned from it. You know, human nature, you learn about yourself. It gives you a sense of ownership. It gives you a sense of accountability, responsibility, pushes you outside of your comfort zone. You know, you need to do things that you never thought you could do before. And so that really is something that I just value so greatly. And so it was, like I mentioned, it was a number of years later that I realized that's one of the things I like about doing this so much, is that I'm giving beauty professionals the opportunity to be entrepreneurs. They don't have to work in somebody else's world. What mm-hmm. most traditional salons are is somebody who started a salon, and they put, let's say, 10 chairs in the salon, and they paint the walls the color they want, they choose the furniture that they want, the owner puts the music on that they want, and they have the temperature, you know, of the air that they like, and they hire the person for the front, and they create the culture, and they decide the hours in which the people who work there should be able to work. They decide what products are going to be used in the salon. So most beauty professionals who work in a salon like that, which is the traditional type of salon, they're working in someone else's world. Mm-hmm. And these are creative people. And so I've always believed that creative people especially work best when they're able to decide how they work, when they work, what they wear to work, the type of clients that they want to interact with every day, the type of hairstyle, the type of hair services that they're doing. If they want to do, you know, super creative, quirky styles that are on the cutting edge of things, and they want to be around those types of clients, then in our environment, they can do that. That's not the case when you're working in a traditional salon. So I felt like I was giving people the opportunity to do what I value so much, which is having kind of that entrepreneurial spirit.
I guess that kind of leads me into my next question is, I'm a real estate guy. I love real estate. I love doing deals. I love learning about concepts. We own and operate shopping centers, and the studio-based salon business seems to do well in our environment. My sense is it's a pretty competitive space. There's other operators out there. You guys seem like best in class, really. But I guess I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about the competition in the space, but more specifically around what makes Salon Republic unique, and really, like, what is it about your business and the model that makes it so resilient?
Sure. So as far as the differentiation and the type of studio salon that I've always believed in and that we've eventually been able to develop across the chain, I believe in a company-owned chain. You know, the franchise model is one that allows people to expand really fast, but I've always believed that the quality of the salon is simply an aggregation of all of the people working in the salon. And it's hard to control the quality of the salon if you're going to focus on selling franchises to franchisees. You know, a lot of the proposition that the franchises in this industry propose to franchisees is what they call a semi-absentee business model. You know, they essentially say to, let's say, somebody who's saved, you know, $750,000 and they don't want to put it in the stock market, they say, okay, well, you can put up this location and you can clip coupons and you can spend the rest of the time on the golf course or, you know, fishing, and it's semi-absentee. You don't really have to put much effort into it. And certainly in all the years that I've been doing this, I've seen a lot of the franchise units, a lot of the franchise salons out there operate in just that way, where the owner isn't there very often. And if, let's say, a light bulb goes out in a hairstylist studio on a Saturday, where she's going to make the majority of her income for the week, there's nobody there to change that light bulb. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to have that kind of support to make that environment, you know, a really, really good one for the beauty professional. So I've always believed in having the control over the units. So we are 100% corporate owned. Another thing that we do is we take a much larger footprint than our competitors do. They tend to average around 5,000 square feet, and then they build a box that has, you know, minimum hallway widths, and then they cram as many studios as possible into that footprint. We take, I would say, our average square footage is about 16,000 square feet. And we have wider hallways than everybody else. We put a lot of nice furniture in the hallways. We put a tremendous amount of effort into interior design. The place needs to look like, I want it to look like the nicest salon that they've ever walked into. And one of the things that is so great about having that larger footprint is a host of things. Number one, we have a much larger presence on the street, okay? It's a substantive looking facility from the street. Number two, it allows us to layer in amenities such as full-time managers. So we have full-time people in the front of the salon in very nice reception area, marble desk, you know, very nice. Everything looks as good as we can possibly make it. And there's a human when you walk in, and the human greets you and helps the client find the beauty professional, helps the beauty professional with some issues that they're having. You know, this is a very human business. And so to not have a human on site presents a lot of problems. So we believe it's very, very important to have that support of the manager at the front. It also allows us to have a beauty supply at the front of our location. So we carry about 80 of the most popular products in the beauty industry, and we have them available at wholesale pricing to our beauty professionals. No one else does that. And one of the reasons why nobody else does it is because nobody has 140. I mean, we have our Beverly Hills location has about 200 beauty professionals in the facility. So that is a critical mass of beauty pros who need to be supplied with professional product. And so we've developed the relationships with the brands and we're able to carry all those products. And so that's a tremendous convenience to a hairstylist to walk down the hall and to buy at the best prices the color that they need for the last minute client that may have just booked, you know, and needs a Redken 6N to do that, let's say that color for a client coming in. So we've been doing that for probably 7 or 8 years. We're still very excited about, you know, that. And our beauty professionals love that kind of convenience. And then the last thing that we do that nobody else does is towel service. We offer free unlimited towels, complimentary unlimited towels to everybody there in the facility. And that, you know, for the real estate people listening, that sounds like maybe not that big of a deal. But if you're a hairstylist and you've got 7 clients on a particular day and you use, let's say, 3 towels per client, at the end of the day, the typical independent hairstylist needs to take that bag of towels and they need to wash them. And oftentimes they're washing them in the salon. So how long does a load of wash take? You know, it takes an hour, hour and 20 minutes. Who wants to hang around for an hour, 20 minutes at the end of their very busy day? You want to go home. So we provide towels for everyone. And it is a tremendous cost because I like to say there's got to be a landfill somewhere with about 1 million of my black towels in it because these things just disappear. Like I don't know where they go. They just incinerate into the atmosphere somewhere. But we continue to buy towels and we have them there on site for all of our beauty professionals to use, and nobody else does that. So we differentiate ourselves with those things, and we've been able to attract the most successful beauty professionals anywhere in all the markets that we operate in. You know, we've one of the early beauty professionals that we got, his name is Guy Tang, and Guy Tang became the most high-profile hairstylist in the world through social media. And, you know, his kind of entertaining antics on YouTube and Instagram. And so Guy was with us for many, many years before he developed his own brand, and now he's not behind the chair anymore. But we have a lot of very, very high-profile hairstylists. We have L'Oreal's number one educator worldwide works in our location, and many, many other top-quality beauty professionals. So we care a great deal about that.
I kind of chuckled for a minute thinking about the 3 towels per day. I have a 13-year-old daughter who, you know, seems to go through a lot of towels, so I guess I have some sense of what kind of impact that potentially has on a salon business. But I'm curious, for those high-profile professionals who've, you know, been with you in the past and the ones that are with you now, do you survey them? Have you found it was really the towel service was kind of the big thing that really, you know, clinched the deal for them? Are there other things about it that really speak to them?
Yeah, we do occasional surveys to test the pulse, but most of the information that we get is just in those one-on-one conversations, since we have, you know, people on site and we get to know the people, and, you know, we develop that community. We get to know the beauty pros who work in our salons, and it's very subjective. I mean, yes, towel service is everybody pretty much who uses towels loves the towel service. But some people might prioritize the fact that they can just walk down the hall and buy the professional products, you know, in the onesie twosies quantities whenever they need it. Some people like that more. Some people like the fact that there's a large community of other beauty professionals who are working independently, but yet provide a community that most people like. So it's very, very subjective.
It sounds like this incredible ecosystem that happens within the walls of the space. And I guess I wasn't aware of the beauty supply aspect to that. And it makes me want to ask more about how that virtuous cycle impacts the other spaces, the entire center. You know, from a landlord's perspective, what is it about Salon Republic that makes this a really desirable use?
Sure. So I would say there's a few answers to that question. Number one, highly resilient tenant. So we have 25 salons right now. We'll have 31 by the middle of 2024. We've been doing this for almost 24 years, and we've only closed one salon. And the only reason we closed is because the landlord practically forced us out because they wanted to repurpose the building. So we've never closed a salon on our own, you know, because the business struggled. That is just so rare in this industry. So, you know, and that includes, of course, the Great Recession. We sailed through the Great Recession just fine. So extremely resilient business model. One of the other things that landlords love about us is the quality of person, the quality of demographic that we bring to a shopping center. You know, our goal when we open a salon is to attract the best beauty professionals in the market. You know, we're not cheap to work in. So the hairstylists who come to work at Salon Republic, they're successful hairstylists and they have well-heeled clients. You know, they have high-income demographic clients. And these are people who, depending on the market, it's somewhere between, let's call it 60 and 80% female clients who come to the salon, and they spend a while in the salon, and they patronize the other tenants in the salon. They eat there, they're gonna shop next door, and these are the exact type of people that 99% of landlords want to come to the center. And that customer is coming because their hairstylist went there. Okay, so the landlord doesn't have to do anything to get this high income demographic to come to the shopping center except for put Salon Republic there, because we are a destination for this type of demographic. So we have gone into more than one struggling shopping center, and within a year, the shopping center has completely turned around. And by the way, because we're a destination, we can take the worst spaces in the shopping center. We can take the elbow of the shopping center. We can take the second floor that's been vacant for 7 years. You know, we love that, because the hairstylist is gonna go where the salon is and the client is gonna go where the salon is. We do not need to be on that that outlot out by the street on the hard corner. So that's the other thing. And then the third thing I would say that landlords love about us, and I never really thought about this until one of the landlords said it maybe 10 years ago. They said, one of the things we love about you guys is that you aggregate personal care services under one tenant. So instead of having, you know, a nail salon in 900 square feet that's owned by a manicurist who's never opened a nail salon before, has never read a lease before, is relatively not creditworthy, relatively unsophisticated, and frankly, difficult to deal with, and then a little salon over there, and then a little waxing place over here, and then maybe there's seven little places in a shopping center, and the landlord has to deal with each of them, you know, they deal with us. And, you know, we've gotten to the point now where we're, you know, somewhat sophisticated. We have about 75 employees. We're creditworthy, the national creditworthy. We've got a facilities group. So when there's, you know, a leak in the facility, we get in there and we fix it in a professional manner. When it comes to interacting with the landlord, we have a real estate group here in the office right behind me. And they're professionals at it. And, you know, they respond quickly and they take care of things and they understand the relationship between landlord and tenant. And so I thought that was kind of interesting when I first heard that.
Oh, it's fascinating on so many levels. I don't often think about your business as you being a landlord per se, and the business of operating real estate is so far removed sometimes from the business of what goes on inside a retail or restaurant space. So, you know, you really have to have a passion for it. You have to have the team that can support it. It sounds like you do. Mm-hmm. How many locations did you say that you have open?
We have 25 open, and we're opening 6 in the next 5 months, if I'm doing the math right, I think.
So it'd be 32 anyway you slice by the end of this.
Yeah, I think we'll be at 31 by the middle of 2024.
And then how about for next year? How many do you think you'll open in 2025?
So next year, our goal is for 10 locations. And we're looking at acquiring some other salons around, typically some people who have gotten into the business and they don't like it very much, or you know, they're not doing a very good job taking care of the hairstylists, and so we're looking at acquiring them as well. So that's the goal.
Smaller footprint salons, you're looking at those 5,000, 6,000 square foot operators and want to grow those?
Nope. Typically, it's larger, or if it's a smaller one with an opportunity to expand it, we really like the larger footprints. You know, I think we're right at the moment, we're looking at 8,000 up into the mid 20,000 neighborhood. Our largest location is about 26,000 square feet.
I never think about yours being kind of a one-stop shop in the wellness, health, beauty space, and that how that dynamic kind of plays out in the center. Who do you like to be around then when you're looking at, you know, potential future opportunity sites?
You know, frankly, we don't really care that much as long as, I know landlords don't hear that very often, but we don't really care that much unless the center has kind of positioned itself in a very kind of discount outlet type of situation. Because we attract, you know, the high quality beauty professionals who want to be able to charge, you know, on the upper end of the market for beauty professionals, to be next to a 99-cent store is not the best for us. But otherwise, we don't really care.
Where do you want Salon Republic to be in 5 years? If I interview you again in that time frame, how many will you have open? What's changed, if anything?
I hope that we have continued to refine the type of salon that we build. I hope that we've continued to maintain the sense of community within each location and across locations. You know, on that note, we throw a holiday party annually that's become quite a thing. This last holiday party we had a month and a half ago, and at the end in December of 2023, we had about 2,000 people in a large kind of nightclub facility in Hollywood, and with pumping music, and a lot of the beauty brands show up, and people like to have fun with each other and meet new people, and we love that community. So hopefully we continue to maintain that sense of being a part of something. And in terms of our footprint, you know, hopefully we continue to grow at a 10 plus pace per year. If we can grow it more than that while maintaining the quality and the community, then that would be a welcome surprise.
That's awesome. I mean, these are not small projects. So if you can take on that kind of pipeline, I mean, that's just really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, we have an in-house construction group that works under our real estate team. And, you know, these guys have worked at, you know, very large publicly traded companies, rolled out dozens of units per year. They've already done this before. And so I've tried to build a team with a tremendous amount of experience so we don't trip ourselves up.
How often are you looking at centers that you want to acquire and turn around?
Oh, well, I mean, in the 24 years, I've found many, many pieces of real estate that I would love to acquire and buy. Typically, historically, it hasn't made a lot of sense. I did buy one, which was a freestanding unit, 12,000 square feet in Colorado. I bought that location. This was right after the subprime washout, 2010. And I bought it directly from the bank who had repossessed the building. We still have that salon. It's still an awesome salon, and that's a company-owned real estate. But in most of the environments in which we operate, you know, Southern California, Texas, Washington State, Colorado, it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to buy the real estate.
I can believe that. You know, this has been really awesome. I had just a couple other questions here. One, specific to the business, you had mentioned, we talked before about the run rate. Mm-hmm. And what is that? Why is it important to your business?
So run rate in terms of us finding beauty professionals for it, or the pace at which we're growing?
I think it was about the turnover that happens in the industry sort of generally, and your business is buffered from that because you experience a much lower rate of turnover, I guess.
Right. So the way that we look at this, if you look across the economy at employees in general, workers in general, typical turnover of an employee is about a third per year, which makes sense. You know, you look around your office, and you know the life expectancy is about 3 years or so. And so that's kind of industry wide. And then you look at my industry in particular, and I think the number, which by the way, is nobody has a good number on this because my industry is so highly fragmented, and there's no data compilation company who's will ever be able to get this kind of accurate data. But most people figure it's about the same. So a salon will turn over about a third of its people every year. The turnover within Salon Republic is in the teens. So we're about half of what the average turnover is. And I think that's just a result of the fact that the beauty professionals are able to build the type of work environment that they want. You know, if they want to make a change in their environment, they let's say they're tired of a certain kind of furniture that they have in there, or they're tired of that really loud paint color on the walls because maybe their life has changed a little bit, they can change it. They don't have to find another salon to work in. You know, so the flexibility and the freedom and that independence allows them just a lot of opportunities.
Well, it's a real testament to the success. Maybe it's a driver of the success in your business, but I just found that to be incredible that there's that kind of delta between sort of what the industry experiences and what Salon Republic experiences. So
yeah,
I get my last question for you, you know, as a landlord, what do you like, what do you need from your landlord partners for Salon Republic to be successful? Who are some of your best landlords? Maybe not by name, but what are they doing to help you win?
Well, we have a lot of different landlords, a lot of the biggest ones that everybody knows. You know, Westfield is a landlord in multiple locations. I don't mind naming them. No reason why I can't. Westfield, we're in a number of their locations. Douglas Emmett, which is primarily an office landlord, we're in a number of their buildings as well. Great relationships with all of our landlords. There's a few that aren't popping into my head at the moment, but we like to develop relationships with landlords and continue to be sent opportunities, you know, from other properties in their portfolio. And we like to have a template lease, you know, with a particular landlord who might prioritize some things and not other things. And so it just kind of expedites the process. We like long-term leases, 10 years plus, because we go in there with a lot of our own money. And so just like a landlord is developing a property, there's a big capital expense component, and that needs to be justified over time with cash flow. So we come in with a lot of our money, and then otherwise we look for, you know, some economic participation in some regard. We're rather flexible in that regard, and sometimes the economic participation that we request from the landlord could be in the form of free rent. Sometimes it's in the form of TI. Every landlord is different. You know, some of our landlords would rather give us TI money and have us start paying a full rent right away. And as long as the economics work for us, that's fine with us. And so we've done it that way. We've come to the table with more cash and then, you know, lower rent in the beginning. You know, it's we have a pretty sophisticated modeling that we do financially, and allows us to be, you know, our balance sheet allows us to be pretty flexible.
Well, Eric, it was great speaking with you today. Thank you for joining me on Retail Intel. Love learning about Salon Republic. It's just an incredible business that you've built. Be on the lookout for new Salon Republic locations opening near you, and be sure to check them out on Instagram at Love Eric Taylor and at Salon Republic. And check out Eric's podcast, The Hair Game, wherever you find your podcasts. Whether you're an aspiring real estate mogul, a seasoned pro, or simply curious about the places where we shop, dine, play, and work, this podcast is your all-access pass to the world of commercial real estate. Connect with me on LinkedIn, and if you're interested in being a part of the Retail Intel podcast, send a message to nationalaccounts@phillipsedison.com. If you want to hear more about new and expanding brands, keep tuning in to Retail Intel. And please subscribe, follow, like, and repost. Talk to you next time.